MacCast, Sunday, September 13th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, what a week. A couple weeks, I guess, we have to go over in Apple and Mac news. There is big stuff happening right around the corner, maybe even by the time you're hearing this podcast. Hopefully, you'll hear it before the thing happens, but we have a special event. Yeah, Apple is going to show off some products, so we're going to talk about what Apple might be delivering us in the next couple days here. Some exciting stuff. Always fun to get into that, get past the rumors and find out what Apple actually has in store. We're going to talk about different products that might be there. We're also going to get into some news surrounding the upcoming iPhone 12, which should be coming sometime in October. Got some Apple TV Plus news to get into. Also, talk about how the iPhone 11 has been doing so far this year in 2020. You might be surprised to find out. We'll get into some iOS 14 news and a feature that it looks like Apple is going to delay. We'll dig a little bit more into the ongoing saga between Epic Games and Apple. Yep, there's more back and forth to talk about this week. And the opening of a brand new Apple store in Singapore. That is pretty unique. It's pretty cool. We'll talk about that, and that'll kind of round out the news for this week. Then we're going to get into some feedback on Apple Watch playlists. I'm going to talk a little bit about Wi-Fi and get into uses for maybe some of your older Wi-Fi technology. You'll find out what that means. And then we're going to have a pretty frank discussion about what it is like right now to be in the position of potentially needing to buy a new Mac, and some of maybe the anxieties and questions and uncertainties that may arise due to the timing of what Apple is doing with their computer systems, right? We're in transition, and that always makes it a little bit weird if you're in the market for a new Mac. And I've got a lot of questions from the community about that, and I just want to give you my take on, you know, how that is and where and why and how you should not have that anxiety. So we'll get into all of that. Should be a great episode. So let's just dive right in. And I'm not even going to wait to bury the lead. I am going to lead with the lead, which is Apple's upcoming special event that's going to be happening on Tuesday, the Apple Time Flies special event, a virtual event. Not going to have any press there in person, but they are going to hold it on Apple's campus. As a matter of fact, they put up a webpage on their site for the virtual event, and it has a little hidden Easter egg feature. If you go to the page on an iOS device, an iPad or an iPhone, and you tap on the little event logo, the Apple logo, you get a whole augmented reality experience that you can play around with. So it's pretty interesting. I won't give away what it is if you haven't seen it yet. Just fire up your Safari on iOS and go to the Apple event page. But the event is going to be streamed live September 15th, starting at 10 a.m. Pacific time from the Steve Jobs Theater on the Apple Park campus. They are saying this one is going to be streamed, I believe. So I don't know if this is going to be pre-produced like they did the last Apple event for Worldwide Developer Conference, or if it actually is truly going to be a live event. We'll just have to wait and see. They are saying live, so we'll take them at their word on that one. As you can probably guess from the title, it is believed that this event is going to focus on Apple Watch. Time flies. Watch, yeah, it all fits. Typically, Apple announces new watches alongside their iPhones, but as with almost everything this year is different. We already know that Apple had plans to delay the announcements and releases of the iPhones. That came up actually in the Worldwide Developer Conference call, or was it the last quarterly results call? I can't remember. It was the last quarterly results call that came up. And so we're not expecting iPhones, but we are expecting Apple Watch. So Apple Watch Series 6 should be coming out. The rumors are looking to be true. We're expecting them to add blood oxygen level monitoring as the main new health feature in it. Also, we're hearing about improved cardiogram or electrocardiogram features. Also, the design is expected to remain mostly the same, although we could always get some new finishes, colors. Of course, new watch bands usually come out seasonally around this time, so the new fall colors, we would expect to see that. There is some hints that there might be a new blue color. Midnight blue, I guess this is also a rumor we've been hearing about surrounding the iPhone 12, that it might come in a new blue color. I'm kind of thinking with a name like Midnight Blue that it could be more like blue-black, sort of like they did with the green model in the iPhone 11. Although the logo for the new event is kind of this pale, lighter blue, and I've seen some mock-ups and some people suspecting that it could be that sort of blue color, but I think they specifically said Midnight Blue, which says to me a deep, rich, dark black style blue. So we could get a new color Apple Watch, and that could be a hint of a possible new color iPhone. They a lot of times like to match those things. And then there was also, it's expected that they're going to drop the Force Touch feature. And that's mostly because they're also removing that from watchOS 7, so it doesn't really make sense to need to have the hardware in there anymore. And Apple has been moving away from Force Touch with all of their products in recent years. So that makes sense. There's also a rumor that I read that it could possibly, the new Apple Watch could possibly have a fast charging feature to help better support the new sleep tracking that's coming in watchOS 7. So the idea is you'd be sleeping through the night, and then when you're getting up in the morning, it would remind you to throw it on the charger, get charged back up for the day. And so if you had a fast charging feature, I think more people would be willing to do that, to know that they're not going to run out with their, to know that they're not going to, excuse me, run out of battery during the day. So those are some of the new features planned for the Apple Watch Series 6, or rumored to be planned for the Apple Watch Series 6. Also at this event, there are possible rumors of a replacement for the Apple Watch Series 3. Most of this information coming from leaker John Prosser. He says this is going to be the lower cost option. Apple has had the Apple Watch Series 3 in the lineup. That was kind of the entry level Apple Watch, and then you would move up from there. He says the design would largely remain the same as the Apple Watch Series 4, with a 40 millimeter and a 44 millimeter size available. One of the things they would do to keep the cost down would be that the new watch would not have some of the more advanced features like the ECG app or the always-on display. Definitely going to be an entry-level model. He also mentions the branding would be that the low-cost model would be the Apple Watch, with the Series 6 possibly getting a new Apple Watch Pro branding. And while on the surface that makes a lot of sense, considering how Apple markets some of their other products and the other parts of the lineup, it kind of brings it in line with all of that, there has been some there has been some conflicting information coming from iMore, who has been calling the new lower-cost Apple Watch replacement for the Apple Watch Series 3 the Apple Watch SE. And, you know, Apple often will play around with different marketing names and different branding leading all the way up to the event. So all of this kind of has to be taken with a grain of salt. We won't really know till Apple actually announces it. So they've probably played around with all this branding. You know, do we take the low-cost model and call it the SE, and that kind of matches with some of our other branding? Do we go the whole Apple Watch Pro route? And I'm sure they've thought of it all. Who knows what they've actually decided on? I guess we'll find out at the event on Tuesday. The other item that is expected to be announced at this event is maybe the new updated 10.8-inch iPad we've been hearing about. Mostly, we think this is going to be an update to the iPad Air. So Apple has the entry-level 10.2-inch iPad, and the iPad Air has not been refreshed in a while. This seems to make sense that this would be the model they would update. It reportedly will have a new edge-to-edge display design with no home button, but it's not going to have Face ID. They're actually going to potentially be moving the Touch ID sensor to the power button. This is something we had heard rumored about a while back, we'd sort of seen some concepts and designs for this. I think there might have even been a patent application that Apple put out. So this would allow them to keep the cost down, not have to put in the touch ID or the face ID sensors, rather, and have a new form of touch ID still be able to have a full, almost edge-to-edge screen on the new iPad. So definitely a new design element here. They're also going to be moving to USB-C from the Lightning connector, and it will also have a smart connector to support the Apple iPad keyboards. So full-featured, kind of bringing the lineup up to date with the rest of the iPad line. And there is a slight chance that we're hearing that there might be a price increase. The current iPad Air starts at $499, and it could get bumped up to about $569, with pricing going up to $599, which is a smaller range. So the rumor seems to indicate that the base price might be going up, but there might not be as much of a price jump on the upper end. And I'm not sure what that means. Maybe there's going to be less sizes in terms of storage, but a little bit of a price bump. That's a little bit unusual for Apple to do. But if there's enough new features in here, and it sounds like there might be packed into this new iPad Air, they could possibly justify it that way. There also seems to be hints that Apple could announce that new Apple One bundle for their services that we talked about in the, I think it was the last episode of the MacCast. We've been hearing that Apple's been considering offering their various services in a single bundle, which, ironic about it, and I think we talked about this last time, is we're hearing that there's going to be multiple bundles. So depending upon which one you pick is how much you're going to save on a monthly basis. So the first one would be Apple Music plus Apple TV, and then they're going to have a version that would then add in Apple News, or Apple Arcade rather, and then another version that would add in Apple News on top of that, and then finally, like, the ultimate bundle that could potentially include some additional iCloud storage. And all of them are expected to be family plans and available at different price points, saving anywhere from $2 to $5 a month, which doesn't sound like a lot. I would hope Apple would offer up a bigger savings than that, but hey, $5 a month, $60 a year, it's a savings nonetheless. And if you're buying all the services together anyway, why not get a better deal? So Apple could announce that, although, you know, that one I'm not so sure about. The other thing that we're hearing about that I don't think is likely to happen is there is some speculation that Apple could use this event to reveal and announce the first Apple Silicon Macs. This seems unlikely to me. It's really, unless they're going to do something like just a preview and kind of hint at what's coming, not something Apple typically does, but we haven't put it past them. I mean, look what they did with the Air Power charging mat. I don't think they want a redo of that, though. So I don't see an Apple Macintosh being included in an Apple Watch iPad event. Doesn't seem very likely. I don't think they're going to do it at the iPhone event in October either. But DigiTimes has recently reported that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation did start producing the 5-millimeter A14X processor, which is expected to be the first one to be used in an Apple Silicon Mac, and also the same processor that's likely to show up in the iPad Pro. They're starting up production in the fourth quarter, so that also makes it seem like it's a little bit early to be announcing the first Apple Silicon Mac. There is debate about which Mac is going to be the first model that we're going to get. We've been hearing some folks in the, hey, there's going to be a new 12-inch MacBook coming. So the MacBook's going to make a big comeback with Apple Silicon. The question would be, would that replace the MacBook Air then? I don't really know. We've also had some other folks claiming, specifically Ming-Chi Kuo, that the first Apple Silicon Mac is going to be an updated 13-inch MacBook Pro. Regardless, I think we're not going to see the first Apple Silicon Mac until next year. Something could come out before the end of the year, possibly, but we're running out of days and time, and there just doesn't seem to be a really right place for it, in my opinion. So I don't expect it at this event, but it is out there. Some people are talking about it. So maybe we could get that and one more thing and have a huge surprise reveal of the first Apple Silicon Mac. And that would be awesome. But again, I don't think it's going to happen. But that should round out the Apple event. Like I said, Apple is going to be live streaming it. I certainly will be watching. I don't know if I'll be able to watch live depending upon my work schedule, but I definitely will be watching after, writing down all the news and information, and we will be covering everything that Apple had to announce and say in a upcoming MacCast not too long after the event. So we'll be talking again and going over everything Apple did have to announce. Another Apple product that we have been discussing for a very long time, I think since about 2019, to be honest, if I were to go back. Has it been that long? I don't know, maybe. Maybe it's only been the last year or so, is Apple's AirTags, their item tracker that's supposed to tie into Find My. They were supposed to come out in May, I believe, of this year. That didn't happen. We haven't seen them. We haven't heard about them much other than through rumors. Well, now, citing supply chain information, Macatakara believes that Apple could finally debut their AirTags item trackers maybe at the iPhone 12 event. So it would be an accessory to go along with the iPhone 12. Apple has already revealed that the iPhone 12 event would be delayed, and many, myself included, expect that event to happen sometime in October, probably mid-October. The piece also says that the AirTags will work with Apple's new App Clips, seeming to suggest the possibility that third-party apps may be able to integrate and work with the AirTags. AirTags are expected to be NFC tags. They're also expected to support ultra-wideband, so if you have an iPhone 11, you'll be able to very accurately pinpoint where your stuff is. Bloomberg's Mark Gurman has said in the past that AirTags would be a premium product and possibly come with a leather carrying case, which is a little bit odd for a item tracker. You would expect them and probably want them to be cheap so you could actually put them on your stuff. The Macatakara rumor has also said that the October event would be where Apple would feature the Apple Watch Series 6, and we now know that's not likely to be the case with the Time Flies event happening this Tuesday, like we just talked about. So, you know, as always with rumors, everything to be taken with a grain of salt. Now, moving back to the iPhone 12 part of that event, we're hearing some conflicting information kind of related to some stuff we talked about in the past about how Apple is going to roll out the iPhone 12s. So as we know from previous rumors, Apple is expected to announce four new models of iPhone, two iPhone 12 models, a 5.4-inch and a 6.1-inch version, and then two iPhone 12 Pro models, the iPhone 12 Pro at 6.1 inches, and the iPhone 12 Pro Max at 6.7 inches. What has been debated is when Apple is actually going to start shipping those products. We've heard most recently that Bloomberg believes that Apple is going to launch their two lower-end iPhone 12 models, the 5.4-inch and the 6.1-inch, on or around the event that they will likely have in October. And then they say the 6.1-inch and 6.7-inch iPhone 12 Pro devices, while they would be announced at the event, they would ship sometime later, possibly into November. So Apple doing this staggered release. And that lineup makes the most sense to me. Now, DigiTimes restated this week their belief that the two 6.1-inch models would actually release first. So you would get an iPhone 12 model and the iPhone 12 Pro model launching in the first wave, probably not long after the event in October, and then that would be followed by the release of the 5.4-inch smaller iPhone 12 and the larger 6.7-inch iPhone 12 Pro Max later. Now, they're basing their prediction on the production timing of the main boards because they say that the 6.1-inch board production kicked off in July, but that the 5.4-inch and 6.7-inch models didn't go into production until mid-August. So Apple, you know, ramping up production, and that's how everything fell. And when you think about it that way, it kind of does make some sense that you'd have the 6.1-inch boards kind of going together just for fabrication purposes. But I would imagine the designs are a bit different, so I don't know if that would really factor into it. But that seems like a weird way to release it. So we'll have to wait and see what Apple ends up doing. My money is on the iPhone 12 models coming out first and then the Pro models after that, which we've seen Apple do in the past. And then finally, Bloomberg also gave a mention of a possible Apple TV update coming sometime next year. Now, the details on this are sparse, but they do mention a faster processor. The current 4K Apple TV has an A10 processor, which is getting pretty long in the tooth, so seems ripe for an update. And they also mention an update to the Apple remote, although they don't give any specifics, so it's a little bit frustrating because I know there's a lot of folks out there who don't really love the Apple remote, the Siri remote that comes with the Apple TV. So who knows what Apple could do to make it better, maybe get rid of the trackpad, something a lot of people don't really like. I don't mind it so much. I don't have much of an issue with my remote. I still do have the orientation issue, you know, where you pick it up sort of upside down, even with the little white ring. You know, it's not a great remote, let's be honest. Another thing that Bloomberg did mention about the remote, though, is it could have integration with the Find My app. So I wonder if Apple would put their own AirTag tracking technology into the remote to help you locate it should you misplace it. And that's been a common complaint about the Apple remote as well, right? That it's easy to lose because it's tiny. So putting that into the Find My thing might be a good move, especially if it has the ultra wideband chip technology in it to really help you pinpoint where that is in the room. So got some new stuff coming around the bend, maybe AirTags, maybe a new Apple TV in 2012, but definitely we're going to get some iPhones before the end of the year, and that's probably going to be happening in October. Staying on the iPhone 12 for a minute, we have some new rumors regarding the 5G technology that might be coming in the iPhone 12, and I have to say, if it turns out to be true, I'm a little bit disappointed because previously we had heard that all of the iPhone 12 models, both the lower cost models and the iPhone 12 Pros, would support both versions of 5G technology. That would be the sub 6 gigahertz and the millimeter wave technology. This week, we have a report from Fast Company, who is citing a, quote, wireless industry source, claiming that only the 6.7-inch iPhone 12 Pro Max will have the support for both 5G technologies, both the sub 6 gigahertz and the faster mmWave 5G technology. The other models, they say, are going to just have the sub 6 gigahertz 5G. Again, this is according to the Fast Company report. They claim the reason is that the larger iPhone 12 Pro Max has enough physical space for the special antenna design that's needed to support the millimeter wave technology, and it has the extra battery capacity to support its higher power requirements. Now, millimeter wave 5G would be able to support speeds of up to 1 gigabit per second, but it's noted that its range is very limited. It would require rolling out of a lot of towers, high density in a lot of areas, and that's not likely to happen in a lot of places. Maybe big cities, but you're not going to find it out in rural areas. And the idea is that the sub 6 gigahertz technology, easier to implement, it's going to be more widely available, but it doesn't have as much of a potential speed bump. Sub 6 gigahertz 5G is reported to have speeds between 100 megabits per second and 150 megabits per second, so faster than 4G, and it's going to be more widely available, and it's more easily deployed, but it's not going to be that super fast millimeter wave technology. So some people might be a little bit disappointed. I have to wonder, too, if maybe this is the kind of thing where the chipsets that are being used in all of the iPhone 12 models would support both technologies, but that maybe just Apple has firmware or software disabled the millimeter wave in the other models of iPhone, just because they don't want to, you know, they couldn't figure out the battery requirements, or there was too much power drain or something like that. And that could be the case. Still would be a little bit disappointing. It'd be nice to have that across the board and not have that differentiation. But especially for folks like me who don't want a big, ginormous phone. I don't know that millimeter wave 5G is going to be that important to me, especially in the first year of a new iPhone. You know, it remains to be seen how widely deployed it's going to be, where you're going to be able to use it. I guess if San Diego turns out to be a market where it is available, that's going to make my buying decision a little bit tougher. But we'll just have to wait and see what happens with that one. Moving on to Apple TV Plus news this week. Apple did pick up a new series over the past week. They are going to get a new limited series called 5 Days at Memorial that is based on a novel of the same name written by Sherry Fink. The story covers healthcare workers at a New Orleans hospital in the first 5 days after Hurricane Katrina. John Ridley, whose work includes 12 Years a Slave, American Crime, and Guerrilla, and Carlton Kuhs, whose work includes Lock and Key, Jack Ryan, and Lost, will serve as the show's runners, writers, and executive producers for the series. Also, Apple sort of tooting their own horn on Apple TV Plus this past week, with a little update to their website to celebrate the Emmy Awards. Apple TV Plus shows have earned 18 Emmy Award nominations, so I would say it's a well-deserved tooting of your own horn, especially in the first year of a new service. The nominations include The Morning Show with 8 nominations, Defending Jacob, which I particularly liked. I think I liked it more than The Morning Show, if I'm being honest. I did enjoy both of them, but Defending Jacob picked up 2 Emmy nominations, and great documentary, The Beastie Boys Story, especially if you're like me, a child of the 80s, grew up with the Beastie Boys. I loved that documentary, and they got 5 Emmy nominations for that. Home, Central Park, and The Elephant Queen rounded out the other 3 of those 18 nominations. So well done, Apple. You know, I do really enjoy most of the content that Apple's put out on Apple TV Plus. I think they're doing a great job with that quality over quantity, and they're picking up on the quantity now. We talked about last week, I think it was my thing of the moment, Ted Lasso, still really enjoying that series. And again, I've got to thank my friend Ken Ray for turning me on to that one. It is, if you're looking for something that has a lot of heart, is just fun and uplifting, although it can be a little bit sad at times, if I'm being honest, check out Ted Lasso. I think you really will enjoy it. According to The Telegraph, Apple has hired executive Tim Connolly, who formerly worked on distribution deals at Disney, Hulu, and Quibi, to join the Apple TV Plus team. It's not clear exactly what role he'll be taking on at Apple TV Plus, but it's likely related to Apple trying to work on more special deals and partnerships for Apple TV Plus, specifically in their Apple TV Plus channels area. It also could be related to recent rumors that Apple is interested in getting more back catalog or live TV content on Apple TV. He seems particularly primed to take on that sort of role, so he could help out Apple in that capacity. But that's kind of the latest on Apple TV Plus. It's likely not too surprising that here in 2020, the iPhone 11 has been a runaway success for Apple. And as a matter of fact, according to the latest data from Omdia, they say that the iPhone 11 was the most shipped phone in the first quarter of 2020. They're estimating that Apple shipped 19.5 million iPhone 11s during the period from January through March of this year. That's about 6 million more units than the iPhone XR did in the same quarter last year. Other Apple phones in the top 10 for shipments in the first quarter of 2020 were the iPhone XR in 5th place, the iPhone 11 Pro Max in 6th place, and the iPhone 11 Pro in 8th place. Now, interestingly, only one Samsung model made the top 10. That was the Galaxy A51 in 2nd place with 6.8 million units shipped. That is less than half the number of phones or iPhone 11s that shipped. So iPhone 11 outshipped Samsung Galaxy by more than twice the number of units, which is pretty outstanding. And what else is interesting is the rest of this list was just filled out with various models from Xiaomi's Redmi line. So the rest were all, you know, Chinese phones, basically. And Apple was the only other one to have multiple phones in the top 10. So pretty interesting numbers coming out of the first quarter of iPhone shipments in 2020, or smartphone shipments, rather, in 2020. A little bit of disappointment this week if you are a fan of Apple's drive toward continued improvements in user and data privacy. That's because Apple has confirmed this week that it will delay a feature in iOS 14 that would require apps to alert users when the app is using third-party tracking features to share your data with advertisers. Basically, all those ads that follow you around the web, right? Those things. Apple was going to alert us in iOS 14 when an app was using those tracking features and allow us to opt out. Basically, or actually more accurately, allow us to opt in. It would be opt out by default. And that's why Facebook and other advertisers have been complaining about the feature, which is designed to give more transparency and control to the users, something that they don't particularly want. They say that people are going to get alerted and, you know, them being opt out would cause them to lose or see an ad revenue drop of between 40 to 50%. They also claim that this will ultimately hurt small to medium-sized businesses who rely on the data so that they can directly target their ads, which allows them to spend less money and have their ads be more cost-effective. So the idea here, and it kind of makes sense, is that smaller companies can spend less because they can highly target the people that they're trying to reach rather than having to take a broader approach, which requires more of an ad spend to get that to get those targets, right, to hit those numbers. And so that is true, but again, I think ultimately it's us who should decide how we want to share and spread our data around, and that's what Apple is going for. Apple agreed to the delay of the requirement to allow developers more time to make the changes they need to implement the new feature. The new feature actually could also indirectly have an impact on Apple's ad revenue, as many freemium games rely on ads and tracking to earn money. And then, of course, those games also generally offer in-app purchases, which Apple directly benefits from through their 30% cut that they get on IAP, in-app purchases. So if some of those games and some of those apps, you know, a lot of them being games, start to lose revenue or lose money because they're not getting the ad revenue, they could potentially not exist in the App Store anymore, and then Apple could lose that in-app purchase revenue. Apple has not given a new date for when the support for the feature will be required. They're saying just sometime in 2021. So the feature still is coming, but Apple just delaying it to give developers more time to implement that feature. So, you know, I don't know if this is Apple kind of bowing down to pressure from Facebook and some of their other partners, maybe a little bit. I hope that's not the case. It doesn't feel like that's something that Apple would do. And hopefully it doesn't mean that they are entertaining or considering maybe not releasing this feature at all. I think they are committed to our overall privacy and security. And I think this will go forward once developers are ready to kind of support it. So I think it's a good gesture on Apple's part, actually, if it is going to take a little bit longer for them to put that together. Another thing that's happening and that developers are being required to do is support Apple's new nutrition label style information for privacy and data sharing on apps in the App Store. Developers are being asked to share details on how they use our information, and that information will be presented in these new labels that sit alongside the apps in the App Store. And Apple did share details on how these labels will look and function in a new developer support document. They say developers will need to identify, quote, all possible data collections and uses, and provide a list of data types that they will be shown in this new App Store labeling. App developers will also need to disclose what the data collected is used for, such as first-party advertising, third-party advertising, is it used for analytics, app functionality, to support product personalization, and they need to say whether their data is linked to a user's account, device, or identity. So all of this ultimately good things, a good thing, Apple really trying to bring transparency to us so we know what's happening and we don't have to read through draconian, you know, really long privacy policies. It's an attempt to surface all of this information, but it does put a lot of onus on the app developers to communicate this information to Apple. So they're going to have to provide all of that, and then Apple will use it to put into and design these new nutrition style labels. And just what they mean by that, in case you're not familiar, if you get food packaging, right, it's got the nutrition label on there. It's designed to be clear, hopefully clear and easy to understand and know what ingredients are in there. In this case, it's going to be, what is an app developer doing with the information that they're collecting about you? And Apple says they will be rolling out these new labels later this year. I would imagine it's going to come probably alongside the release of iOS 14 and some new App Store updates and stuff like that. So looking forward to that. I think that's really nice to have that kind of transparency and make it really easy and clear to understand which apps are doing what with our data. The battle between Apple and Epic Games rages on. The spat between Apple and Epic Games is set to be a long one, and it looks like Epic is actually willing to sacrifice a lot to make their case. In recent court documents, Epic Games says that the number of daily users playing Fortnite on iOS is now down 60%, and they also note that about 63% of users who play on iOS only play on iOS. So that means they're really not playing the game much anymore, which directly affects Fortnite and Epic Games revenue. They say that iOS users on Fortnite, there are 116 million of them, definitely the largest segment on any platform. They didn't specifically talk numbers in terms of revenue loss, but some estimates from a company called BuyShares show that the revenue from the App Store so far this year for Epic Games is estimated at $191.42 million. And from that, they can estimate, based on that percentage of users that are on iOS, that Epic Games could be losing about $26.7 million a month from App Store revenue as long as they keep this little dispute going on. Now, to be clear, we talked about this in the last episode of the MacCast, Epic Games definitely put themselves in this place. They were the ones who did the things that they knew were going to get them kicked out of the App Store. They could easily get back in the App Store by simply removing their own payment system that they snuck into the app behind Apple's back. Apple has stated that several times. That would put them back in the App Store. They just need to restore Apple's in-app purchase system. So they are actively choosing to forego this amount of revenue, this number of users, because I guess, honestly, they feel their fight is worth it. So you have to give them a little bit of kudos on that, right? That takes a lot of guts to lose that kind of revenue over something like this, and it's something that could drag on, so they could lose significant revenue. I guess they believe it's not something that could ultimately harm the company, although to me it seems like it potentially could. So it'll be, again, it already has been, interesting to see how this is playing out. Now, speaking of playing out, Apple has now also countersued for breach of contract, asking for damages in the form of the revenue that they're losing while Epic is not using Apple's in-app purchase system. So Apple going after that 30% revenue that they are losing because Epic Games basically is using their own payment platform. The game is still available to anybody who downloaded it via iOS prior to it being removed from the App Store. What's happening now, as you might know, is you just can't get app updates from Epic for Fortnite. So there's a lot of people that still have it installed. Obviously, some of them still playing. And last time I checked, about a week ago, they were only using their own payment system, Epic. So they had completely removed Apple's payment system. Previously, you had both options, and they just said, hey, if you want to pay less, you know, use our payment platform, not Apple's. Now it's looking to me like they only have their own system in there, and Apple obviously not happy about that, saying, hey, you need to pay us for all those purchases that aren't going through our payment system. And so they filed a countersuit to try and get that. They're also looking for a permanent injunction to ban Epic's direct payment option in all apps, including Fortnite. So they want to make sure that they can never have their own payment system in an iOS app in the future. Of course, Epic's CEO Todd Sweeney responded to Apple's counterclaim on Twitter, mostly responding to Apple's comment in their claim that the lawsuit is, quote, basically a disagreement over money. Now, it's a little hard to believe that it's not about the money, but Sweeney alluding to and saying, nope, it's not. And to be fair, Epic's lawsuit is not asking for any amount of money. They're just asking for the right for themselves and, frankly, all developers to be able to use a payment system that is not Apple's. They also want the ability to have their own game store, basically to compete but on Apple's platform. And with the current rules, the way they're set up now, you really can't do that. You can compete on other platforms, and that's sort of Apple's argument. Hey, we're not the only platform where Fortnite is. You can go other places, you can do other things, but on our system, you agreed to our rules. This is how it works, and you need to play by those rules. So, you know, Epic not going after money. Apple is going after money, and if you look at this countersuit, so you can kind of see that argument going on. It's a little thinly veiled, you know, still having a, you know, that system that Epic wants is ultimately about Apple being able to bypass Apple's payment platform, bypass their 30% cut, and get a bigger share of the money. So yes, it's ultimately about money. And, you know, to say it's not, little disingenuous if you're asking me. Now, another thing that Apple had been trying to use as leverage potentially against Epic was the sign in with Apple API. They had threatened that, you know, once they pulled the developer license for Epic Games, Epic would no longer be able to use sign in with Apple. A little good faith on Apple. They, at the last minute, reversed that decision. They are allowing Epic to still use sign in with Apple despite shutting down their developer account. And you generally need to have a developer account to go along with that. So, you know, that was the last minute reprieve. Epic had been sort of scrambling and telling their users to get off of sign in with Apple to sign up directly. They're still advising customers to do that because they don't know how all of this Apple stuff is going to play out in the long run. So that was all going on. That was kind of the stuff with Epic and Fortnite. Another battle that has been sort of going on with Apple and the App Store is the ability for streaming game services to come into the Apple Store. Again, the issue is the rule that Apple has that says you can't have your kind of own app distribution system within an app. So you can't, you know, sort of sell other apps inside your app that only work inside that app. It's all a little bit confusing, but I think you know what I mean. Basically, you can't have an app store. You can't have an app store within the Apple App Store within your app. And they changed the guidelines a little bit this week to, you know, basically allow streaming games, but of course they did it in a way that really no streaming gaming app app is going to want to do. So this was kind of to help appease the folks like Microsoft or Google who have these streaming app platforms and aren't able to put out an iOS app that can offer access to that. So what Apple did was they basically said, hey, you can have a streaming game app in iOS, but you have to adhere to all of the guidelines for even non-streaming apps in the App Store. And so that means that each game update must be submitted to Apple for review, just like individual apps. Developers must provide the appropriate metadata for searching in the App Store. Games also must use Apple's in-app purchase option to unlock features or functionality if they have in-app purchases. And of course, that means Apple gets their, 30% cut. And that's all kind of fine and okay, probably not that big a deal, but here's really the part that doesn't work. Apple says that each game in a multi-game streaming subscription needs to be submitted separately to the App Store for review. Okay, they might be willing to do that, but then there's a big and. And each game must link to an individual App Store product page. So basically, every one of those apps has to be a standalone app in the App Store, in addition to being sort of part of that multi-game streaming subscription service. So you can see where this would cause a lot of these services to not want to do that. Basically, Apple wants it to work in a way like Apple Arcade games do, right? Apple Arcade, the games exist in the App Store as individual games. You pay for a subscription and then you get access to those games. But they're still in the Apple App Store. So Apple's kind of saying you can have your own App Store within your streaming game app, but hey, those games need to also be in the App Store proper. It's all a little bit weird, and it's probably not really going to work, and it means that most of these streaming gaming services are not going to be available on iOS, which kind of stinks because it ultimately just ends up hurting some customers. And really what the streaming gaming services want is they want to be treated more sort of like Netflix would be, or some other streaming service, right? Where you can go in, you pay a subscription, but then you have access to that entire catalog from within the app. You can play those games from within the app, all that sort of thing. We don't have to have separate movies outside of Netflix, right? At least not Netflix movies. I guess you could argue you kind of have it with the TV app, right, and purchasing movies individually, but not really kind of the same thing. There might be some crossover there, but it's not that sort of requirement. So it's all getting a little bit weird. Apple kind of trying to show that they're making it possible, and they did in a way, technically, but really practically not going to happen. And then finally in the news for this week, Apple has an amazing new Apple Store open now in Singapore. It's their third Singapore store. The Apple Marina Bay Sands opened up this past week. And if you haven't seen this thing, I actually, the first time I saw it, had to do a double take. Somebody sent me a photograph of it, and I literally, I thought it was some futuristic 3D rendering, because it is a floating sphere on the water, on the bay in Singapore. Now, I think technically it's not really floating, but it looks like it definitely is floating. And what's kind of cool about this thing is you enter from a tunnel in the shops at Marina Bay Sands in Singapore, and it's the first Apple store that the entrance is an escalator. I think it's actually the first Apple store that has an escalator. So you basically go through this tunnel, you go up an escalator up into this giant sphere, glass sphere, that has a 360-degree view of the city and the bay. It's like a lot of Apple stores, they've got actually trees in there. So there's a grove, there's all the products. They've got some great new displays that aren't at any other Apple store. And it's this all glass dome structure that is fully self-supported. It's actually comprised of 114 pieces of custom glass. Apple likes their custom glass. And it is beautiful. It's like nothing you've ever seen before in your life. So if you haven't had a chance to see the pictures online, look up or Google Apple Marina Bay Sands. Another cool feature that's in there is, of course, they have that custom video wall. But in this case, the video wall on the backside has a glowing white Apple logo and a mirror finish that then reflects back the city skyline and the water from the bay. So there's some cool pictures of people taking that, and you've got this great reflection. Another unique feature is it's the first Apple store to feature an underwater boardroom for business meetings, training, and special events. Didn't see any photos of that. I'm actually wondering if they actually have portholes or glass where you get to see out into the bay, or if it's just, you know, literally rooms underwater and they just happen to be underwater. You just don't know it. But it is a cool Apple store. Like I said, I didn't think it was real the first time I saw it. And the fact that this thing exists makes me infinitely happy. You know, I'd love to go there someday and actually be able to see it. If you're in Singapore, of course, right now, I think they let some folks in through special appointment, special reservation. I don't think it's fully open at this point, so I don't know how you get into see it. But hopefully once all this stuff is over, if you're living in Singapore or near Singapore, you'll get a chance to visit this store. It's definitely, definitely unique. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you need to deploy a server, Linode and the Linode Cloud is what you need. Instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode Cloud. You can get a server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution resources, and you can do it in any one of their 10 node locations. Best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit, so you can take that, you can try it out right away, and it definitely is more than just hosting. With Linode, you get all the options and choices you need to build a server with the services and features you want. Whatever your requirements, you can build it on Linode. Dedicated CPUs, distributed applications, hosted services, websites, continuous integration environments, continuous delivery environments, you can do it all with the Linode Cloud. And all of their servers feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. And you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers. They have super simple pricing with no surprise fees. You pay for just what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their cloud manager makes managing your Linodes and upgrading your plan super simple, super easy. It's hands down one of the best user interfaces for a control panel that I have ever used. So visit linode.com/Maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com, linode.com/Maccast. And a big thank you to Linode for their support of the show. I have a little follow-up to the comment that Gary left for us last week regarding syncing Apple Watch playlists, or syncing playlists to an Apple Watch, I guess is more accurate. You may remember Gary was letting us know about a limitation related to that, where you need to have your Apple Watch on the charger and close to your phone to be able to sync the playlists over to your Apple Watch. And so that's really just how the feature works. Your Apple Watch has to be close. I think that's because, oddly, it seems like it needs to go over Bluetooth, which is not maybe the fastest way to do it. And the only reason I think that is because another thing mentioned in the instructions for syncing playlists to the Apple Watch is that you do need to have the Bluetooth enabled. I don't know why they wouldn't do it over Wi-Fi. Maybe it just does the handshake over Bluetooth. Regardless, Gary was struggling with this a little bit last week, and just wanted to point out that limitation. And Gary, I have to tell you, I got an email from Kevin this week, who also does syncing of his playlist to his Apple Watch. And he noticed that if you actually, for whatever reason, sync your playlist to your phone first, so I don't know if you're already syncing your playlist to your phone or not, he said that the syncing to the Apple Watch goes much quicker. And I have to imagine that maybe the reason for that is that maybe if the playlists aren't already on the iPhone, it has to sync those over at first anyway. So even if you're not syncing your playlists to your iPhone, maybe it does sync them there first, because most of the syncing to your Apple Watch happens directly from your phone itself. So maybe it's doing a two-step process, and if you already have those tracks on your iPhone, it's not going to have to do the first, you know, download to your phone and then over to the Apple Watch. So that might be what's going on, but try that out. Let me know if that works for you, if it makes that syncing process a little bit easier. And thanks, Kevin, for writing in and letting us know about that tip. So we had a conversation a little ways back on the MacCast about newer Wi-Fi routers. And specifically, we talked a little bit about mesh routers or just getting a new router in general, because if you're like me, a lot of us are AirPort fans. We've had Apple AirPort routers for a long time. Apple discontinued those a few years back, and they're getting a little bit long in the tooth, right? There's newer Wi-Fi technologies coming out. Wi-Fi 6 is coming out. And so many of us are in the market for kind of newer Wi-Fi routers. So we had this conversation, and something that came out of it is we got a recommendation from a listener along with a review about the new Netgear Orbi Wi-Fi 6 products. And I've actually been hearing a lot from members of our community who have switched over to the Orbi Wi-Fi 6 products and are absolutely loving it. So it wasn't just one person in our community. A lot of folks saying this is the way to go. They're not cheap. It is a pretty pricey option. I want to say it runs about $600-700 to get the system, but it's supposed to be super easy to set up, super easy to use, and really fast and work very, very well. And so that's great. A lot of people really taking advantage of that. But as I mentioned, a lot of us are switching away from Apple's older AirPort or Time Capsule systems. And as you probably know, one of the great features of the Time Capsule and also Apple's AirPort is the ability to connect a USB hard drive to the AirPort Extreme, or use the hard drive that's built into the Time Capsule to do network Time Machine backups. And newer solutions like the Netgear Orbi Wi-Fi 6 don't have Time Machine built in, so there's not a way to do that. Now, you could get the functionality back by buying a new NAS drive like the Western Digital MyCloud products, or maybe a Synology. Actually, that's what I use in my house. I have a Synology, and we use that for network backups of Time Machine, and that stuff works great. But again, that can be expensive. You're buying a whole new NAS on top of your Orbi Netgear Wi-Fi 6 system, and that's a lot of money to be spending, especially when you still have a Time Capsule that's probably working just fine. Or maybe you have a hard drive connected to your AirPort Extreme and that solution's been working great for you, but you replace your router and now suddenly you don't have access to that. And so that's what happened this week. Is listener Dan got a new Orbi system. He wrote in and said, hey, is it possible to disable the Wi-Fi router part of my Time Capsule, but then still use it connected to the network as a Time Machine backup, a network Time Machine backup? And the good news, Dan, is yes, it is. And better still, it would even work with an AirPort Extreme if you have a USB drive connected to the USB port. And it's actually fairly easy to do. You're basically just turning that into a network attached storage device that has Time Machine support. So all you have to do is go into your applications utilities and launch the AirPort utility. And then, of course, select your base station, click on the edit button, and then you'll probably need to enter the base station's admin password if you're prompted for that. You'll click on the wireless tab in the AirPort utility settings, and then from the network mode pop-up menu, just turn that off. Turn off the network mode. Click update and the base station will restart and load its new settings, and then you can just plug that in to the network port on your Orbi, and you will be able to use it as a still use it as your Time Capsule, that is, you'll be able to still use your time capsule as a network storage for Time Machine. And like I said, that should also work if you have an Airport Extreme. So pretty straightforward. I found out about this from Glenn Fleischman over at Macworld. He has a great article posted up about this. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But that's a great way to reuse and continue to use your time capsule or airport. So that's pretty cool. Thank you, Dan, for sending in that question, because it was something, honestly, I hadn't thought about. And I'm probably in the market for a new router. I do have an Airport Extreme. Like I said, I'm not using it for Time Machine backup, but I actually might start now that I know you can do this. So hopefully a lot of folks in our community get benefit out of that. And you might be pulling your old airport or time capsule out of storage because you also maybe didn't realize that this was even a possibility. So thanks for that. And if anybody else has other tips or tricks or things that you can do with older time capsules or Airport Extremes, shoot us additional emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. All right, last thing that I want to talk to you about this week is when to buy a new Mac. Now, we're living in a strange time, to be sure. And I'm not just talking about 2020 and the pandemic and all the other things that are happening in the world. It is a strange time again where Apple and the Mac are in transition. And we haven't been in this place in a really long time, not since Apple was doing the move from PowerPC to Intel. And just like back then, it was a little bit weird. It's a little bit weird again with the announcement of Apple Silicon and the officially transitioning again. A lot of folks who might be in the market for or need a new Mac start to ask a lot of questions. And I think these are very reasonable questions to be asking. All these questions start to arise is like, why should I buy a new Intel-based Mac right now, which is basically going to be obsolete the minute I buy it because I know the new Apple Silicon versions are coming, and that's the future of Apple, and Intel is really the past. And so that's one question, right? It's like, why buy the old stuff when I know the new stuff's coming? And another question that then immediately follows that is, well, like, wait a minute. Do I really want to buy the first generation of a brand new platform? Apple Silicon, we don't know what it's going to do. We don't know how well it's going to, you know, perform. Is it going to be compatible with all my stuff? Is it really smart to buy the first generation of a new platform? What if Apple totally screws it up and gets it completely wrong and these things are horrible? You know, do I want to be the guinea pig that finds out that this didn't work out and Apple's going to ultimately go back to Intel, which possibly could happen based on the success of the iPad and what their processors do over there? I highly doubt it, but certainly enters your mind, right? It's like, what if this is a big screw up? Or what if none of my software works with this thing? Or what if there's all kinds of problems? You know, what about that? And then you flip flop back and you say, well, but I don't want to miss out on the latest and greatest technology when it comes out, do I? You know, like if I buy a new Mac now, I'm probably not going to be buying another machine for several years, and I'm going to watch all these generations of this great Apple Silicon stuff go by, and it's going to have high performance and better battery life, and I'm not going to get any of those advantages. So, right? You start to get stressed out, and it's like, what is going on here? What do I do? I don't know what to do because we're in transition, and we start to freak out, right? And I bring this up not because people are necessarily freaking out. That's probably too harsh a term. But people are definitely questioning, you know, what to do in this situation. And I'm getting a lot of questions from the community about, hey, I really, my Mac is really long in the tooth. I was planning on buying one this year. Now Apple's thrown this monkey wrench in here. I just don't know what to do. Adam, help me. Help me decide what to do. And here's the thing. And here's where we need to have a frank conversation, and we need to sit down and talk this out. All of these questions are valid. All of these things can create anxiety if you're faced with a new Mac purchase right now, and I totally get it. At the end of the day, though, I can't help you. I really can't. You need to make the choice that is right for you and your situation, and everybody's situation is going to be infinitely different depending upon how much you rely on your Mac, whether you're using it for business or pleasure, what you're doing with it, what are the applications, right? All that stuff has to come into play here. And all I can really do is share with you how I feel about it. And then you can decide if you see it the same way I do, if it really applies to you, if it doesn't apply to you. And so I can share my thoughts because it may help you come to your own conclusions. But ultimately, you're going to have to come to your own conclusions about this. But when I think about this stuff and I think about this transition, because you know, I'm one of those folks, I just bought a brand new Mac. I bought a 16-inch MacBook Pro, so I'm going to be on Intel. And I keep my Macs, you know, generally for 4 to 5 years. So I'm going to be with this machine for 4 to 5 years. And some of you might be going, well, aren't you going to be bummed that you don't have a new Apple Silicon Mac? And you know, on the surface of it, yeah, because I'm a nerd and I'm a geek and I love Apple technology and I always want the latest and greatest, right? And probably if I could afford it, I might, you know, buy a new machine sooner, but that's not really how things generally work out for me. So for me, when I'm thinking about buying a new Mac, I feel like you have to take, or, and this is more about deciding when to buy a new Mac, right? And not so much what new Mac you're going to buy, but you know, when do I buy a new Mac? Do I wait? Do I not wait? And for me, that's when you have to take the specs and the wow factor and a little bit of your ego out of the equation. And that's sometimes hard to do, right? I'm a nerd. I love the newest, latest, and greatest stuff. I care about this stuff a lot. You know, I want the coolest, sexiest, hottest new thing that Apple has put out on the market. But the reason I say you have to kind of take the specs and the wow factor out of it is because if you're like me, as I mentioned, when you're buying a new Mac, you're probably replacing a system that is 3 to 5 years old, maybe even older, depending upon what your use case is. And from any perspective, you know, that means that any new Mac you're going to buy is going to be much better and newer technology than what you currently have. It is going to be a vast improvement in terms of the specs and the wow factor and the technology for you. Now, is it going to be the latest and greatest thing that's coming out on the market 2 months from the time you buy that machine? Probably not, but then that's always the case. There's always going to be something coming out that's better than the thing that you currently have. So you kind of can't worry about that stuff, right? And that's why I say the bigger point is, does it even matter? Does it even matter that, you know, an Apple Silicon Mac comes out a month after you bought your hot new top-of-the-line Intel Mac? And I argue that it doesn't. It really, really doesn't. Because for most of us, especially me and maybe you, my computer is a tool, right? It's there to serve as a vehicle for me to get stuff done. That's its job. That's what I need it to do. My criteria for that tool is that it does its job efficiently, it does its job reliably, and that it allows me to get my work done and do it well. And that's it. That's what I need the machine for, right? And so it's not about what CPU it has in it or GPU. And I don't mean the specs of that, right? That obviously is important because that goes to that efficiency part of the equation. Like, is it fast enough? Does it help me do my job quicker and better and stuff like that, right? That's great. You need to meet all that criteria, and that's part of the criteria of, does the machine get the job done for me? But what is certainly not important, and what you probably don't need to care about, is what is the brand of those components that go into that criteria of getting the job done? Is it an Intel? Is it an Apple? Doesn't really matter. As long as the performance and reliability criteria are met, right, I say, who cares, right? It's like, it needs to run Mac OS, it needs to do it efficiently, it needs to run all my software, it needs to do that efficiently, it needs to do all that reliably, and it needs to get all that stuff done. Yes, having the newest flashy technology can be super ego-boosting, it can make you really feel good about the tool you're using, but it doesn't change the tool, right? It just, it helps you feel better. Like, hey, yeah, I got the awesome new, you know, touch bar that I never use. Great. That's really awesome, Adam. But, you know, is it helping you get the job done? Maybe sometimes, but probably not so much. I probably could have saved a little money and maybe not had that, right? Or I don't know, but I think you get the point, right? This is what we're talking about here. So I say buy the thing that is going to get the work done when you need to get the work done. So if you've reached a phase with your current machine where it's actually hindering you, it's a tool that is no longer working for you, you need to get a better tool. And you only have the option to buy the tool that's currently available to you. Like, regardless of, you know, knowing that some months from now, and that's an unknown too, something better is going to come along, right? You have to get the thing that you can get now and buy that. And that's the thing you should be using. Getting the job done today is going to be the thing that allows you to eventually buy the next new great tool tomorrow, right? Especially, again, if you're using your machine for work. Like I said, I'm oversimplifying this a bit, but I think you get the point. Like I said at the beginning, you're going to have to decide for yourself. Apple's current machines on Intel are proven, reliable. They work great with the current operating system. They are going to get the job done. They're going to do it very well and efficiently. They run today's apps with today's technology, right? And as much as Apple Silicon looks like it's going to be absolutely amazing, that's on paper at this point, right? That's just on spec. We don't know. There's a lot of unknown and unproven factors that could come into play. And I can almost guarantee you there's going to be bumps somewhere along that road. We already know that, you know, some apps might not work as well or might not work at all in Apple Silicon, at least until the developers get in and change or update the software to better support it, right? So that's a factor. That's something that you have to think about. You know, do you want to be on that cutting, bleeding edge? And maybe you do. Maybe you're like, yeah, absolutely. I want to be the test user. I want to be right there along with Apple going through that process. And I'm willing to take on those risks. That's awesome. That's great. Then you should be waiting to buy a new machine. Or, you know, do you stick with the older proven technology that's reliable and use that? And, you know, neither answer is right or wrong. Again, it just depends on your personal situation and what you're looking to do. But certainly, I think we have to get past this point of having anxiety, this, you know, the next great thing is coming anxiety. And it's hard to do. As, you know, as the geeks we are, this is our lot in life. It's the thing that we suffer with. We always long for the next big thing, that one more thing, right? If we're Apple fans. And I think you just have to let it go sometimes, right? And it just gets particularly hard in these transition phases because, you know, it's going to be really cool. And we know it's going to be really cool, likely, right? We don't have 100% certainty, but, you know, I think it's going to be an amazing future for Apple with their own chips. And I think they're going to be doing some amazing things. Again, I'm basing that on the proof of how awesome iPads are and how awesome iPhones are in terms of performance and energy efficiency and all those things that Apple is great at doing. And the integration of the hardware and the software is, I think, one of the things that sets Apple distinctly apart from their competitors and allows them to do more than their competitors can do with potentially a lot less. And it's incredible. So I'm looking forward to the future. But I'm saying let's not worry too much about the future, especially if you need a tool to get some work done right now, because Apple has some of the best machines they've had in their lineup. Like that new iMac that Apple announced, unbelievable, incredible. This 16-inch MacBook Pro, I absolutely love this thing. You know, the MacBook, yeah, there are just so many options. The Mac Mini, even though it's a couple years long in the tooth, that is an awesome machine. We use some of them at work, and they're incredible. So don't shy away from the current technology just because there's new stuff on the horizon, or don't feel like you need to, right? If you're willing to wait and you want to wait, great. More power to you. And so that was kind of the conversation I wanted to have today. Again, these are my opinions. These are my thoughts. You don't have to agree with them. And in fact, if you disagree with them, I'd love to hear from you. Or if you agree with them, shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander and PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iOS. And PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram, just MacCast over there. And that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.